This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am your host for today's interview. And I'm speaking with Josephine Lee. Dr. Lee is professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Minnesota, just down the road from me in the Twin Cities, and she is also the author of the new book, Oriental Black and White, The Formation of Racial Habits in American Theater, which came out with the University of North Carolina Press just last year in 2022. Welcome to the New Books Network, Joe. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's such an honor to be here.
Why don't we begin, as we always do on this podcast, by just hearing a little bit about who you are. I'm curious about what your background is, and especially I'm interested in hearing how you became interested in all the topics that you study in theater, in literature, in history, and just kind of in storytelling in general.
So as someone who was born and raised in New Jersey in the shadow of Manhattan, right on the Hudson River line, I've always been in an environment where the performing arts were really important. But some of that, I think my interest in theater is a quirk of my own upbringing. As a kid, I used to check out collections of new plays from the library and just read them. So I've been interested in drama and literature and theater from early on, though I was never much of an actor. I actually did my undergraduate degree in physics and switched to the humanities, and then went on and got my graduate degree in English with an emphasis on dramatic literature of a number of periods.
Can I ask you, as just one quick follow-up, did you ever perform in a play yourself?
I was in a number of acting classes. I did a lot of playwriting, actually, when I was a college student. I worked with a playwright, unfortunately now deceased, A.R. Gurney Jr., who was teaching at my school at MIT at the time. And we performed in each other's plays. I also did some acting lessons over at HB Studios in New York when I was a graduate student. None of that was something that I really felt like I needed to continue. Again, I'm happy to be behind the scenes, mostly. I just dramaturged a new production that's opened last weekend in the Twin Cities, or opened last night in the Twin Cities, called The Chinese Lady. It's a play by Lloyd Suh, and I highly recommend it. I know by the time this podcast comes out, that might be irrelevant, but Steve, if you want to be there, it's a great play.
We should talk about that after we are done recording, because I'd love to hear more, yeah. Since I'm local. I'm curious also, what brought you to the specific topic of this book? Why write a book about American theater and race in the 19th and especially early 20th century?
Yeah, you know, I've been writing about race in American theater for a really long time. So my first book was Performing Asian America, and that came out in 1997. And in that book, I looked specifically at plays by Asian Americans written from the 1960s on. And so these were contemporary works that looked at Asian American playwrights with a lot of emphasis on the staging of racial and ethnic identity and different kinds of racial interactions. That book focused on contemporary drama and performance, but I've always been interested in theater history too. And so my graduate work way back in the 80s was not actually about Asian American theater, but was a kind of heavy lift of 19th century British drama, including works by Oscar Wilde and George Bernard Shaw. So in 2010, I kind of returned to some of that training and worked on a book I published that was a production history of Gilbert and Sullivan's light opera, The Mikado. And The Mikado was a play or an opera rather that came out in the late 19th century that has been sort of continuously produced again and again, not just in the UK, but in the United States and in fact all over the world. And I looked at a variety of productions of that 19th century opera, particularly with a focus on how it represented Japan and used in most productions, yellow face, which is the practice of white actors or singers playing versions of Japanese characters. And so I looked at this comic opera, you know, sort of from the time it came out in the 1880s until today. And among the most interesting productions that I found were a set of productions that were done by African-American casts. And these included a production called the Swing Mikado. And it was a version of the Mikado where they kind of jazzed up Arthur Sullivan's music. This was copied by an African-American version called the Hot Mikado, and both of them were competing versions of the Mikado that were produced on Broadway in 1939. So when I was doing work on this section of the Mikado book, it got me thinking about how representations and both of Japanese and other Asian characters might be understood differently when we see them as being played by Black rather than white performers. And my research on the Mikado started unearthing more and more examples of this kind of cross-racial performance, which is not often what we think about when we think about cross-racial casting. We all know a lot about, for instance, the history of blackface minstrelsy in which white performers blacked up. We also know more and more, I think, about yellowface performance in terms of white actors playing oriental roles. But we don't really think about how actors who are not white also played racialized roles. And this led me to the project that eventually became Oriental Black and White.
So let's get into some of the big ideas in this book. And there's a term that you use quite a bit that some of our listeners might be familiar with, but others might not be. Can you explain what you mean when you talk about Orientalism, what that term means, where it comes from, and why it matters so much for the story that you're telling here?
So I'll start with a really well-known book that uses this term, and this would be Edward Said's 1978 book called Orientalism. And Said uses the term Orientalism to describe how Europe, the UK, and the US, how scholars and officials and popular culture viewed societies and people in Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East. So a large part of the world that was headed under the term the Orient. And what Said discusses and lays out is that there's a kind of binary opposition that's posited and understood and assumed between the so-called Orient and the Occident, right, which is the West. And that opposition also has a power dynamic that comes with it, in which the Orient is is seen as a kind of space of barbarism, irrationality, and chaos, as opposed to the Occident, the West, as the place of civilization and progress. So when I was thinking about my book, Performing Asian America, I thought about Said a lot. And I'm really interested generally on racial representation. And I'm interested in theater. So I was particularly interested in how Said emphasizes a kind of Orientalism as a kind of theatrical mindset. And so one of my favorite quotes from Said is when he says, "The Orient is the stage on which the whole East is confined. On the stage will appear the figures whose role it is to represent the larger whole from which they emanate." So this quotation to me kind of captures how particular character types in theater are interesting because they represent a group identity, right? Whether that identity is about national culture or in many cases about race in the United States. So racial stereotypes, I think, help us to understand how a whole group of people who are very, very diverse and have a lot of variation in terms of who they actually are can be flattened into one type of character. And that character can be kind of reproduced again and again and again in the theater.
And one of the first examples that you give in the book is kind of actually more in contemporary times. You start by talking about two Disney versions of the story of Aladdin. The early 90s, probably pretty well-known animated version, and the maybe slightly less well-known, more recent live-action version. And I'm curious how these two tellings of this story, how they play into themes of Orientalism, and what the deeper history of the Aladdin story is in American theater as it relates to your book.
Oh, that's a really great question. You know, the Aladdin chapter is, for me, one of the interesting, most interesting parts of the book to reflect upon now that it's written and published. As you probably know, as a historian, the curse of any kind of historical research is success. It is finding way too much in the archive to write about. So when I initially pitched, you know, this book to different university presses, I think the version that I had was, you know, like well over 200,000 words and 14 or 15 chapters long, and several of the presses that I approached said, "Whoa, we can't publish anything this long." So I had to think about how to cut it to a more reasonable length. And there were a lot of people who advised that I cut sections like the section on Aladdin, right? And one of the reasons is that Aladdin is a story that does not confine itself to the US. Right. So the chapter on Aladdin kind of starts with British productions of this. And in fact, Aladdin is a story was taken from the collection of Arabian Nights tales that were translated into English and other European languages in the 18th century. It's a story that is sort of much older than when I was pitching the book. I said, well, it's kind of about the 19th century. But the Aladdin story actually was translated in the 18th century. So I felt like, though, when I was thinking about, well, what in the book had to go, I couldn't give up Aladdin, because one of the things about Aladdin is that it shows, I think, some important things about how race and different meanings around race operate in and through the theater, right? So race is something that's present in American life as a kind of social issue, but it's also got an interesting relationship. The everyday performance of race has an interesting relationship to the theater. And so I feel like the theater, what the theater does with racial representations is it takes certain stories and certain values around race And then it repeats them again and again and again. And it repeats them, in the case of Aladdin, as a form of popular entertainment. So the Aladdin story is interesting because it soon became not just a story that was told, but also as a play, and that had a really successful life as a theatrical production, and now as a movie, like the Disney movie. And one of the things I found was really interesting about Aladdin is that it was not devoid of racial meanings, even from its onset. So in the story, which is originally set in China, and I think later versions, particularly American ones, have moved the story to the Middle East, it has a kind of racialized setting, and then, you know, shows the many characters, you know, the kingdom as being a Chinese one. And then it also identifies certain characters as specifically being Black. And in the original Aladdin's, it was the evil magician who's the antagonist of the piece. The magician, and then a number of interesting servant characters or slave figures are also identified as Black. And what I found most interesting, I think, in my reading of Aladdin was how the story kept giving us similar versions of different racialized figures that were not just Black and white, right? So you have a story that's kind of oriental or orientalized, and it also includes, as part of its meaning or part of its working, a set of characters who are identified as Black. And I think that still exists even in the Disney films, right? I think there's some explicit references to Blackness that I think are really, really interesting and kind of reveal themselves again in Disney. I don't want to spoil people's readings. I want them to go and read the book to find out how.
One of the really important characters, especially early on in the book, is someone named Ira Aldridge, who you talk a fair amount about. And I thought his story was really interesting. I'm not a scholar of theater, but I had not heard of him and thought he was a pretty fascinating person. Can you tell us who Aldridge was, and in particular, what kind of roles he played and how those helped to kind of shape ideas about identity and what you call racial habits in 19th century American theater?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I love talking about Aldridge and Aladdin because, again, when I was thinking about the book or trying to pitch the book, these were chapters that were on kind of the earlier part of the 19th century or even earlier than that. And they were the parts of the book that some readers thought, well, maybe this shouldn't be in the book. But I thought it was really important to acknowledge Aldridge as a leading Black actor, right? And at a time in which there really were no other figures of that stature. So Aldrich, you first hear of Ira Aldrich as someone who worked in perhaps the first Black theater company in the United States, and that was the African Grove Theater Company in New York, which lived for only a short time. And Aldrich was present there when the African Grove was playing in the early 1820s. He, like other Black artists did throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, he lacked any opportunity in the U.S. The African Grove Theater was shut down. He moved then to the United Kingdom and Europe, and he spent the rest of his career there. And he was quite well known and had a kind of remarkable reputation. And there are a number of scholars. There's a wonderful 4-volume biography of Aldrich, if anyone's interested, by Bernd Lindfors. A number of scholars have written about his performances of Shakespeare. So he was best known for playing Shakespeare, and Othello, perhaps understandably, was his most characteristic role. So I think a lot of people have written about his performances of Othello. My chapter departs from that kind of thing, and what I look at are some of the roles that Aldrich wasn't kind of talked about for, particularly in the present day. But these are roles that he also received critical praise for by reviewers. And unfortunately, these are roles that we would call quite stereotypical. They're roles that were based on some of the comic blackface roles of the time. And he played a number of kind of foolish, inept, and sometimes drunken servants. And the two that I look at are a servant character named Mungo in a kind of operatic afterpiece called The Padlock. And Mungo was a very famous character type. And there's also a piece, there's also a character who is a servant named Ginger Blue, and that is in a play called The Mummy that came about in the kind of mid-19th century. And that was a role that was first brought to the American stage by a man who's sometimes considered the founder of blackface minstrelsy, or one of the fathers of blackface minstrelsy, Thomas Dartmouth Rice, right? And Rice pioneered this character of Ginger Blue. But it's interesting because Aldrich also played this character. And I argue that his performance of Ginger Blue is quite different from Rice's, or we must look at it differently from Rice's. There's another side to these characters, which is that they all have these Oriental aspects built into them, right? So we're looking at Aldrich playing blackface roles, but there are also roles that have a kind of Oriental dimension. And we know that he played Oriental characters, such as a character from Aladdin as well. So I'm trying to show that Aldrich did something that a number of Black actors did in their time period by taking on Oriental roles. He was trying to show more of his talent and skill as an actor. So even though these roles are stereotypical, the fact that he could move between them so well, I think shows the kind of actor that he was.
Still thinking a bit about Aldrich, but other actors from the period as well. You know, one of the big points you make in the book, one of the major arguments and topics and themes in the book, is the connection between Orientalism and minstrelsy in American theater in the 19th and into the 20th centuries. Can you talk a bit about these connections, why they exist, and what we can learn from looking, for instance, at these particular connections between blackface performances and yellowface performances in theater?
Yeah, thank you so much. I was really intrigued by the fact that minstrelsy, which was a kind of prevalent form in American theater, I would say through much of the 19th century into the 20th century, and dominated sort of views of blackness and race and how that should be represented. I was really struck by how many times minstrelsy also included allusions to other races, right, including what we might call sort of Orientalist representation. And I think my book gave me an opportunity to really delve into the ways in which, when people were playing minstrel characters, in other words, black characters, black stereotypes, they also included other kinds of representations of other races. Like there were minstrel sketches that included Chinese characters, Chinese immigrant characters. And I think that there is this kind of constant interplay and awareness between the representation of blackness and the representation of Orientals, and particularly Chinese immigrants at the time. And so there's a complex moment in history when you realize there are a lot of different people on the kind of American scene, and there's a kind of social anxiety that revolves around race, and it is multifaceted, it is multiracial.
And all of these systems of identity and things, like racialization, for instance, they don't exist in a vacuum either. They also are connected to other sort of identity-forming mechanisms. And there's a really great part in the book where you talk about the connections between racialized performances and performances of gender and sexuality in American theater as well in the same time period. Can you talk a bit about these connections and how they crop up in theater performances from this time?
Yeah, I mean, that's so well put. It is really a book that's influenced by, I think, what we call intersectionality, right? That there is not really a way of talking about race without talking about gender and sexuality or other aspects of social identity, right? That there are all kinds of examples of how looking at certain figures in these plays that come up again and again, involves looking not just as how they were racialized, how they were understood to be racial characters, but how they were understood either in terms of gender and or sexuality. So one example might be the figure of the Chinese laundryman. And there is a good deal in this book that's about a regular kind of comic sketch that involved the Chinese immigrant laundryman, right? Or laundry worker or laundry business. And one of the things that looking at these pieces involves is not just how these immigrants were understood as a form of racialized labor or maybe labor competition. In other words, the Chinese coming to America were seen as competitors for white working class jobs, but also how they related to domestic work, right? So when the Chinese immigrants were discouraged or not allowed into kind of masculine labor, they often took on domestic roles. And so within the idea of the Chinese laundry, right, is that Chinese immigrants, male immigrants, are doing women's work. And that feeds into seeing them as kind of emasculated and or sexually dangerous figures. And another example in the book might also be, you know, the ways in which gender plays into who's allowed to actually make a living on the stage and how. And so I'm thinking about some of the roles that were available to African-American women who wanted to perform. And so there's a number of interesting examples that I look at in one of the chapters that has to do with the opportunities for African-American women to perform what might be called Oriental dances. And during the Chicago World Exposition in 1893 on the Midway, there was this huge craze for what were called Oriental dances, dances from that were imagined to be from Egypt or Turkey or other parts of the so-called Orient. And what's interesting, I think, in the research is that African-American women started to perform these roles and sort of took them on as their own and made them an opportunity to be more visible in show business. And this was not just in vaudeville, but also on the kind of more classical or renowned stages of musicals and even opera.
So I'm a historian by training, and as a historian, I am a little bit obsessed with context. Not to say that history has a monopoly on context, but it's something that we think about a lot in over here at History Land. And so throughout a lot of this book, I was thinking about, well, what is going on in the United States and in the world that is making all of these topics so popular in American theater? I guess what I'm asking is, why Orientalism in American theater at this particular moment? Why Orientalism and ideas about East Asia and people from East Asia generally, why do these become such, for lack of a better term, such popular topics or tropes in American theater during the period that you're studying here?
I love that question because it sort of brings in, maybe a lot of us appreciate history, right? But it sort of looks a little different, I think, from the point of view of doing theater history, right? That history might be seen as a kind of succession of moments. You know, one time period produces certain set of conditions followed by another time period. Theater keeps repeating those moments, right? So a play that was written in the 19th century might be reproduced today, maybe modernized a little bit, but the basic storyline is still the same. So theater is full of these sort of resurrections of history. And it also, I think, in some ways repurposes things, conditions of history. So I think there's some wonderful historians who have written about Orientalism. You know, among them is John Coy Chen, who wrote a wonderful book a number of years ago called New York Before Chinatown. And he talks about different varieties of Orientalism in different moments, sort of starting with the 18th century into the 19th century, right? So a colonial America to a sort of moment in which Chinese migration became much more kind of known and anti-Chinese feeling grew, which is in the later part of the 19th century. So in this sort of earlier period, Chen identifies different kinds and attitudes towards the Orient. And so it sort of starts with the association of the Orient with wealth and trade and luxury. And this maybe goes back all the way to Marco Polo and the spice trade, right? The Orient is the space where you can have kind of adventure and profit. It's also a space that's associated with things that are really spectacular and decorative and exotic in terms of commodities. And I think all of that kind of makes its way into theater, right? So theater is full of, and there are examples throughout my book, you know, in which theater is a space where people go to be kind of impressed and entertained, right? So what we might say the kind of exotic and even decorative dimensions of Orientalism are really, really present, whether they're in spectacular settings or costumes or mysterious characters that promise adventure, or even the versions of the Aladdin story, you know, which are basically versions of kind of exotic tourism, you know, for Western adventurers to sort of go and witness. And so you have that, you know, and I think that is very much ingrained, but still appears today. I think you also have some other versions of Orientalism that come about later, and those have to do with the versions of what we might call the yellow peril, right, which is a kind of stereotype that grew around the idea of Imperial Japan, right? So when Japan became open to the West and then became more modern and had aspirations to be the sort of imperial power in Asia, then you got the Yellow Peril imagery, right? Stereotypes of Japanese as this kind of marauding culture. You also had the Yellow Peril in terms of immigration and labor. And so in the U.S. in particular, there's a lot of familiarity with seeing Asia as an economic competitor and seeing Asians as a kind of labor force that would put white people in particular, other people as well, but particularly white people out of jobs. So you have this kind of Yellow Peril Orientalism that also makes its way into certain stories in the book. And finally, I think, you know, another version of Orientalism might be the ways in which imperialism kind of starts to creep in. And so there's a chapter on plays about the Philippines, particularly during the Spanish-American and the Philippines, the war in the Philippines. And it's about kind of associations of manifest destiny and benevolent assimilation of what were called little brown brothers, right, the Filipinos, and that as a kind of form of Orientalist discourse.
So This is, of course, the New Books Network American West channel, American West podcast. We haven't really talked about place all that much as far as where this book takes place so far in our conversation. And a lot of the book takes place in the East. I mean, New York City is, of course, the major hub of theater in the United States. But I'm curious to what extent you think this is also a story about the American West. So how does the West come into play here? How do you see this as a Western story as well as an Eastern story?
Yes, I think that's a great question, because we often think about New York as being the center of theater work. But those of us who live in the Midwest know that that actually isn't the full story, right? And I think it's true in this book as well, right? That a lot of the productions that I write about, including productions that were given by all Black companies, which traveled across the United States, those are everywhere, and including the American West. And I do feel like that kind of way in which theater travels is pretty much a kind of given. And what it's doing is, of course, creating a kind of national identity in which encompasses certain values that we associate with the American West. I think the chapter that really focuses on this most is chapter 4, and that's about a couple of melodramas, and one of them is a play that's pretty much forgotten now, but was extremely, extremely popular, a melodrama called Across the Continent, which came out in 1870. And another melodrama, which is written by Bret Hart and Mark Twain, and both of those are writers that we know are maybe a little more familiar with. And that came out in 1877, and it was called Ah Sin. And both of those melodramas are about the American West, or have scenes in the American West. And what's interesting is that is in conversation with a particular stock character. These are the first plays in which we see the Chinese immigrant as a comic type. And what's interesting with these characters is they emerge in conjunction with a kind of vision of the West, as well as with mining in California, the gold rush, right, which is the reason why a number of Chinese immigrants came. The second thing that's interesting, I think, about these plays is that these Chinese characters come in, but they're also paired with Black characters, with Black servant characters. And there's these plays, the way they're depicted never gets that far away from what I would call the characteristic tropes of blackface minstrelsy. It's kind of like these characters were new characters because they were Chinese, but they were also really based on older characters that were Black originally.
So as we begin to wrap up here, I always like to ask my guests to take kind of a different perspective on their book and put yourself in the shoes of someone who has read this book and has then put the book back on the shelf, left it behind for 6 months or a year or 2 years, and then thinks back to this book. What would you hope that reader comes away remembering? What do you hope their big takeaway from your book might be?
So I am enjoying this because my husband's actually reading this book. He's not an academic, and it's taking him a while to get through it. I mean, each chapter in some ways has its own kind of focal point. I think the larger takeaway, once you've gotten through the whole thing, maybe it's sort of two things. One is to appreciate Black theater history, right? Theater that was made by and about Black characters, made by Black performers for and concerned Black characters, as being really foundational to American theater history, right? That I think we often think about American theater history as a kind of white theater history, and that's just not true. There was a lot of performance by African Americans that we don't really think about, right? And one of the things that I think is interesting about that is that those performances included performances that were not not of Black people or white people. They included many other characters, including a lot of Oriental characters. And even though it's troubling to think of Black actors as performing Oriental stereotypes, I think it might prompt us to sort of think about those interactions and those judgments a little differently. So I think that takeaway, the larger takeaway, is that the theater, I think, is complicated in the same way that race in the U.S. is complicated, right? Race in the U.S. encompasses multiple groups of people who interacted or maybe played different kinds of roles, social roles on a regular basis. And race isn't just one set of binary oppositions, and it's much more complex. And so I feel as though this book makes me very, very kind of humble and willing to look at very specific things and think about them more carefully without necessarily reaching one conclusion.
I think those are both excellent takeaways. And to your first point, you know, I went into this book, and of course I had read a synopsis before emailing you about coming on the show, but I kind of had an assumption that it was, you know, mostly going to be about Orientalism in American theater. And I came away understanding so much more about Black actors and Black theater in the 19th and 20th century than I ever thought I would. We talked a bit about Aldridge earlier, but there's so much more on that topic in this book than I ever expected. That was kind of a really nice surprise for me.
Oh, thank you so much.
And then for my last question before I let you go, I always like to get a preview from my guests about what they are working on next. And this book's been out for about a year or so. So I'm curious what project you've been working on in the interim. What do we have coming up next from you?
So I had mentioned that the original part of this book, the original version of this book was way too long. So what I did is I took some parts out and I developed them more. And I have a new book, a very small book, people might be relieved to know, on American musical theater and race. And that just came out last month. It's called Race in American Musical Theater, and that actually follows up on some of the material I wasn't able to use, but it also has material on much more contemporary musicals. So in this Oriental Black and White, sort of, I made myself stop at 1925 because it felt like looking at the earlier kind of roots idea was very compelling to me, but there were a lot of examples of interesting kind of ideas about race and musicals that I felt like I wanted to follow up on. So Race in American Musical Theater is what I did next.
That sounds fantastic. And actually, before I let you go, before we wrap up here, I had one last question I wanted to ask you. I should point out to everyone listening that this book is available completely free and open online, and I'll be sure to put a link to the book in the show notes for this episode. But I'm curious, Joe, why you made the conscious decision to make this book open like that? Sort of what your thinking was there, what your plan was.
Well, I think, you know, as an academic, as a professor, I'm really interested in the ways that our research can get out into the wider world. And because I work on theater, I made the conscious decision many years ago. I think after my first book, Performing Asian America, came out, there is a man I know who reviewed it on a theater website, and he said, oh, this is not bedtime reading. And so I really took that to heart, and I thought the kinds of creative work and the artists that I'm writing on, what are they going to say when they read my book? And why, while I don't know that I've entirely gotten away from the kind of detail and maybe nerdishness that theater nerds might appreciate, I want the book to be able to be read by anyone, right? It's not got sort of jargon in it. I hope that people can just take a chapter and look at it if you're interested, and it doesn't stand as something that I don't want things to get in the way of reading it. And I do that also because my Mikado book, when I took that road, actually had a little bit of an impact on how opera was looking at things like works like the Mikado. So maybe readers will know that there has been some activism and protest around racial representation and particularly the use of yellowface. And I'm happy to say that there have been a number of theater artists and dance artists and musicians who've read the Mikado book and have said, well, you know, now we get it. Now we see this. And so I made this book open access so that other people could do that and take a look at it just for fun. And the Mikado book's going to be open access hopefully in the next year as well. So just kind of giving back in any way that I can.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I think that that's the kind of thing that we hope all of our books and research can do, is to make that kind of real tangible change in the world. So congratulations on having that kind of impact. Yeah. Dr. Josephine Lee is a professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Minnesota, and she's the author of the new book, Oriental, Black, and White, The Formation of Racial Habits in American Theater, which came out with the University of North Carolina Press just last year in 2022. Thank you so much for joining me today, Joe. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.